This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to No Bad Ideas, the storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas on the internet and try to turn them into stories that are actually good.
My name is Gabriel Urbina, and I am your first Bad Ideas host.
My name is Sarah Shackett. I'm not Zach Valenti. I'm your second Bad Ideas host.
Yes, unfortunately, Zach is missing in action. He has been sequestered from this episode due to various life callings and higher purposes.
What a loser, having a life.
We wish him well on his week off and are sure that he'll be back next week for a new No Bad Ideas. But in the meantime, we're very, very excited to welcome our guest co-host for this episode, the wonderful writer and friend, longtime friend of the show, the author of the upcoming Prank Master General, it's Zoe Tokushige. How are you doing?
Hi. I think me and Zach are just destined to be ship staff, passing in the night.
Just like forever at each other's opposite sides. Yes. But we're thrilled to have you, though. Thank you so much for coming on the show and stepping into Zach Valenti's chair.
Oh, God. Don't put that on me.
There's absolutely no pressure. There's only everyone's opinions of Zach Valenti riding on you right now.
That's what I'm afraid of. He's so popular.
But you're so brilliant and you're going to do an amazing job. Zoe, do you want to, before we get started on the show, do you want to tell folks a little bit just about like who you are, what you do, what is this upcoming masterpiece that you are working on?
Yeah, so I'm Zoe. I met Gabrielle 15 years ago at a summer program in Oxford.
The blackmail amounts that we have on each other are very elevated, very high.
I told Sarah I was considering pulling up one of our pen pal letters and just reading it.
I mean, that would be a bad idea.
I highly encouraged this, by the way.
You're saved by the fact that I forgot. I said I was going to do this.
Dodge that bullet.
I think my main connection with the show now is that I am your guys' dungeon master for our long ongoing D&D game.
Multi-year campaign. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're coming up on 3 years at the end of this.
Which is wild.
Yeah. Only a year and a half of that was spent doing Strahd Module.
We were thorough. Okay.
You
escaped. It's fine.
Yeah.
So I'm a publishing professional. I have an MFA in creative writing from Emerson College, and I have a book coming out from Philomel, which is an imprint of Penguin Young Readers, in September or August of next year. Somewhere around there. I don't think the official date has been decided on.
End of the summer.
But we can start getting excited for it right now.
That's
the takeaway that I'm getting.
Yeah.
Get hyped,
please,
everyone.
Do. It is the first in the Irie Sano Prankmaster General Illustrated Middle Grade series. The first book is going to be called New School Skirmish, pitched as Diary of a Wimpy Kid Meets Problem Child and Dennis the Menace. The series features sixth grade prankster Irie Sano, a Japanese-American military brat who always gets in trouble at school, until she meets a teacher who gets to the heart of her troubles, unearthing an unaddressed learning disability and a spirited kid trying to find her way when the road keeps changing. So, yeah. I just got to see illustration sketches the other day, and I'm really excited.
That's awesome.
Alrighty. Well, that all sounds great. We have that to look forward to. But before that, and before the year of waiting for that, we have a little bit of business to attend to. We have to turn two bad ideas into good stories, or at least the premises for good stories, or at least the beginnings of the possibilities of premises for good stories in just 10 very, very short minutes. And I believe that I have the first bad idea tonight. Are you guys ready to jump on in?
Ready and worried.
Yeah.
That should be our show tagline here. The show motto, ready and worried.
That is exactly the right attitude to have. Go ahead and hit us.
So this bad idea comes from where the bad ideas all meet up to kind of like exchange notes and learn from one another. Reddit's infamous Am I the Asshole subreddit.
Sure.
And dear listeners, for anyone that would like to read along and then read the ensuing discussion about this post, you will be able to find a link to it in the episode description. But the headline reads, Am I the Asshole for Deleting My Friend's Wedding Photos in Front of Them?
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
I want to hear the story about this. I will say that. I'm hooked.
Great. Well, let's get to it. The text itself reads, I'm not really a photographer. I'm a dog groomer. I take lots of photos of dogs all day to put on my Facebook and my Instagram. It's my thing, if that makes sense. A cut and a photo with every appointment. I very seldom shoot things other than dogs, even if I have a nice setup. But a friend got married a few days ago and, wanting to save money, asked if I'd shoot it for them. I told him it's not really my forte, but he convinced me by saying he didn't care if they were perfect. They were on a shoestring budget, and I agreed to shoot it for $250, which is nothing for a 10-hour event. I agree. That is very, very cheap. On the day of, I'm driving around following the bride as she goes from appointment to appointment before the ceremony, taking photos along the way. I shoot the ceremony itself, and during the reception, I'm shooting the speeches and people mingling. I started work around 11 a.m. and was due to finish around 7:30. Around 5 p.m., food is being served, and I was told I cannot stop to eat because I need to be photographer. In fact, they didn't save me a spot at any table. I'm getting tired at this point and kind of regretting doing this for next to nothing. It's also unbelievably hot. The venue is an old veterans legion, and it's like 110 degrees Fahrenheit, and there's no air conditioning. I told the groom I need to take off for 20 minutes to get something to eat and drink. There's no open bar or anything. I can't even get water, and my two water bottles are long empty.
Okay.
He tells me I need to either be a photographer. I love how they're using this term. I need to either be a photographer or leave without pay. With the heat, with being hungry, with being generally annoyed at the circumstances, I asked if he was sure, and he said yes. So I deleted all the photos I took in front of him and took off, saying I'm not his photographer anymore. If I was to be paid $250, honestly, at that point, I would have paid $250 just for a glass of cold water and somewhere to sit for 5 minutes. So, was I the asshole? They went right on their honeymoon and they've all been off of social media. But a lot of people have been posting on their wall asking about photos with zero responses. Oof. So, that is what we're working for.
Just to start off, I have photographed a wedding before for someone I didn't know. I think they paid me more. It was for less time and they fed me afterwards.
Yeah, no, this like there's a lot basic. Of bad choices being yeah. made here by the yeah. wedding haver.
Also, like very strong opinion for the groom to have on his wedding day dealing with a photographer.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't interfere anyway.
Let me set 10 minutes on the clock, which are starting right now. How do we turn this into a good story?
Okay, so there's the actual story that exists, which would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I do sort of like the premise of dude has a photographer friend, asks to do his wedding and gets in over his head. And we can sort of expand out what that means instead of a hot Veterans Legion hall. What a yeah. romantic spot to get married, by the way. Or I don't know. Maybe that's just where they had the reception. But like, it could be.
I think
like,
that still though. Like, what a choice of a venue.
Shoestring budget. I get it.
My parents got married in a Chinese restaurant. I can't judge.
Fair.
Fair enough.
But like, we could, if we wanted to like make it like a sort of wacky supernatural comedy where this dude is marrying into a family of like vampires or banshees or something. And this dude is having to photograph things that don't photograph because they are spirits or something like that. And sort of do the challenge that way. Or I'm curious if either of you guys have a different thought for like another way we could sort of twist it into a wedding from hell that this poor photographer has to deal with, but maybe without
the literal hell.
Yeah, the literal hell that happened. Yeah.
I think the biggest choice to be made is whether deleting the photos is the culmination of the story or the inciting incident, you know, because like there is a movie that ends with kind of like, you know, the fight that happens afterwards. And then there's the movie that kind of like begins with this. And then it's about like the fallout from this.
I was going to say you could go for more of a psychological horror angle because the heat part is what really got me. And it was making me think of Summer of Sam by Spike Lee, where like the heat of that movie is like almost its own presence within that film. And like the images of people just getting sweatier and sweatier in a place without an open bar. I don't know what that means.
That's less photogenic as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I don't know exactly what that means in terms of like, was there just no drinks at all? I'm very curious about this because this photographer did not seem to be able to get any sort of drink.
Yeah, no. It seems that like the facilities at this wedding were not at all what they should have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even without an open bar, surely there was water at the tables. But perhaps that is perhaps that is an assumption.
But they were
also
not allowed.
Was this wedding during COVID times?
Possibly. One second. Let me check because this may have been an older post. Let me see.
Because I'm picturing the added addition of masks.
Of masks, yeah. Ooh, which makes it even hotter.
It was posted 20 days ago as of the date of recording. So no dice.
Okay.
It could be one of those like just very psychological, no soundtrack, just non-diegetic music throughout, European films where you just watch all of the characters have complete psychological breakdowns over the course of the movie.
Every relationship is ruined by the end of this film.
And there's just kind of this like high-pitched droning that like recurs over certain points in the movie instead of like having a proper soundtrack.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Or like you hear ABBA playing, but because you are in a scene outside of the wall, you don't really get to enjoy it. It's just like the echo of the dance floor.
Yeah. I am also just like fascinated by like how like I think that the real asshole here, needless to say, is the groom.
Yeah.
And just like how strict they were being. And I'm like, I'm almost imagining it's almost like the whiplash of like photographer wedding experiences where it's sort of, you know, kind of like, let me see that photo. No, you didn't get it right. Do it again. Like, you know, and this is like, can we like move on? Like there's like a long queue and it's like, well, then you better get this right so that the rest of the queue can come in and get their photos taken.
So you are proposing Whiplash, the wedding edition is what I'm hearing.
Still starring J.K. Simmons.
Still starring J.K. Simmons. He is the groom.
He might need to be the father of the groom, but yeah.
I was going to say, that puts a whole new spin on it if J.K. Simmons is the groom.
He could be the father of the groom, but I guess that's a question of like, how close do we want this photographer to be to the groom? Are they like best friends and this just brings out a whole different side of him? Or, you know, sort of tangential acquaintances or something else?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because, you know, there is kind of that element of a lot of probably why this happened is because this was kind of a friend request. So you're not doing it with like the contract and we're not talking about like, I need to have like, you know, my like breaks every half hour or whatever. And when are we going to time those, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. It's like, I'm doing you a solid and in return, you're going to be cool. And that just that deal, that unspoken arrangement broke down.
My question is, how do we get the dog grooming part in? Because there was a lot of detail about him being a dog groomer at the beginning of this piece.
Yeah, that's a great question. Maybe it's like customers of his are the ones that are getting married. Mm. And so it's like everyone is at this wedding with their dogs. You know, and it's like 101 Dalmatian style, like, you know, kind of these two people found each other and they were both clients of this dog groomer.
I see.
And they met through her, and they have kind of this like very, very like intense dog grooming community, which I mean, I think that then like that adds a little bit of heat to why the photographer would put up with a certain amount of abuse up front, because there is kind of this like, I don't want to poison the well. Yeah.
That one star Yelp review would really destroy them.
Right.
Over a barrel. Now, are we going so art house European where at the end, like, he's officiating a marriage between two of the dogs? Like, how
yes,
crazy?
Of course. What is that question, Sarah?
Understood. I'm on the same page now.
This is now basically a Fellini film. Like, yeah.
Yes. Part of his contract also is that he had to like groom the dogs who are also ring bearers.
Uh-huh.
Of course. Excellent. Right. Yeah, no. And like the dogs get water. Like, you oh, know, yeah. The dogs get yes. breaks.
There's a water fountain for the dogs.
You have, like, the shot of him staring longingly at the dogs drinking water in, like, uh-huh. slow motion with just, like, tinkly piano music mm-hmm. in the background. Mm-hmm.
No, and I think that, honestly, like, the centerpiece of the movie would be that scene where he's surrounded by people and then they move off to something and he's about to follow. And then he notices, like, wait a minute, I've been left alone. And he glances down and there's this dog water bowl like on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of this like, no, I have dignity.
But
keep
you?
Staring at it. Shot of the water bowl, shot of the person. They inch a tiny bit closer. And it's like, oh, God, are we really doing this?
This feels like a Werner Herzog movie at this point.
It really is not now a Werner Herzog movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think he'd be into it. I'm just saying.
Oh, he absolutely would.
Marriage Story plus Werner Herzog sells itself.
Plus dogs. Yeah.
Plus 101 Dalmatians.
Yeah. There you go. Instead of doing more Cruella bullshit, do this.
Has anyone asked Werner Herzog his opinion on the movie Cats 2019?
I don't think anyone has.
Oh, God. Jesus.
But he would have a great opinion on it.
He would. I think that is pre-made to go viral.
Yeah, I would not pay to watch Cats even now, even though I think it's free on some streaming service. But I would pay for a live stream of Werner Herzog watching Cats, the movie
right.
That I think would be amazing.
How does this end? Like, what is kind of the final straw for our dog groomer turned photographer?
Are they given dogs?
The dog gets a piece of cake.
Yeah, they're given dog food to eat and the dogs get to eat cake.
Yeah.
So it just goes like full surreal. Like at a certain point, like it just like completely gets flipped around.
I think it has to be one of those films that on TV Tropes that has a big like Wild Mess guests page that's about, is it all hallucination at the end? What part does it become a hallucination?
Right, like at what right. point exactly did the protagonist have a psychotic break and they are now, and we have now lost all, you know, relation to reality. Right.
The entire wedding party, including the photographer, wanders off naked into the desert and that's how it ends.
Wow.
I was thinking the photographer gets down on all fours like a dog.
Oh yeah, at some point. Absolutely. Yeah, that too.
With 15 seconds remaining on the clock, what is the title of this honestly terrifying movie? Like, this is like, like this is like now creepier than a lot of things that have been marketed as horror.
500 Dog Days of Summer.
Ooh, that's like not it. Bad. And that is also time.
Perfect.
Wow.
Amazing.
I have to say, this may be the closest that we've stayed to a no bad ideas, like, base idea in a long time, but also like we went far,
but also the
like,
furthest afield.
Yeah. Wow. That was very, very impressive. Very my hat's off for my dog bow goes off to the two of you.
I just want to say this is one of the classic examples of I am the asshole posts, which I love. I'm obsessed with reading the Twitters that are dedicated to that and like the Reddit relationships stuff. But yeah. My favorite I am the asshole ones are the ones where you read the headline and you're like, yeah, it kind of sounds like you were the jerk. And then as the post
and then
goes
you read
on,
it and
you're
like, no,
actually,
delete
no,
those were, photos. Yeah.
Yeah, one, you 100%. Reacted far more calmly than I would have in that yeah. situation.
Right. Yeah. No, like I think that if I'd been in that position, I would have broken the camera on the dude's face. Like it would have been bad. Yeah.
No, that does. It was not a good situation at all. And I think his behavior was rather justified. I have another bad situation for you guys, if you are ready to do another bad idea.
Let's do it.
Awesome. So take this with a grain of salt, because I tracked it down through Twitter and Reddit. And the only English language article about this comes from Ars Technica.
The three most unimpeachable sources that you could possibly ever
exactly.
want, Sarah.
Right. So this is 1,000% real, what I'm about to describe to you.
Great.
But dear listeners, if you would like to read along to this very factual article, it will be in the episode description linked. So let's just get into it. The headline reads, let's make a deal. Entrepreneur wants to trade shuttle for a skull.
Okay.
Yes.
Is he putting on a production of Hamlet or something?
Well, it will be made clear why this gentleman wants this particular skull. But tensions are continuing to escalate between a Kazakh businessman and Russian space officials over the fate of the second Buran-class orbiter named Burya. The businessman, Darin Musa, claims ownership of the Burya, which was the second orbiter built as part of the Soviet orbiting program, which aimed to produce a fleet of space shuttle-like vehicles 4 decades ago. At the time of the program's cancellation in 1993 due to a lack of funding, the Burya vehicle was almost fully constructed. It was 95% completed for flight operations. So this shuttle never made it to space, but it was very close. The first shuttle in this line made a single unpiloted flight to orbit in 1988. However, that vehicle was destroyed in 2002 after the roof of the hangar where it was stored in the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan collapsed. And the loss of the original shuttle makes the Burya all the more valuable to Russian space officials.
Hmm.
It was located in a separate facility in the Baikonur Cosmodrome. After it was vandalized by graffiti artists this spring, Russian officials, including head of Roscosmos, Dmitry Rogozin, became increasingly concerned about its stability and its future. Musa, however, does not simply want to give the vehicle back to Russia. In September, reports emerged that he would return it only in exchange for the skull of the last Kazakh Khan, a man named, I'm going to butcher this, Kenisary Kazimov.
Okay, okay. So it's not just skull.
It's the skull.
I see.
Yes,
okay.
Of a man who emerged as a hero in modern day Kazakhstan for leading a 10-year struggle opposing the Russian Empire in the 1840s. A rival ultimately beheaded Kenisary Kazimov in 1848 and sent his head to Russia. Now, Musa wants the skull back, and he is willing to trade the shuttle for it. In an interview published on Friday in Russian language newspaper in Kazakhstan, Musa escalated his rhetoric. He said that he would not allow the shuttle to be returned to Russia for nothing. Quote, it is not water that flows in our veins, but blood, and it has the scent of wormwood. Note, wormwood is a common plant in Kazakhstan and a key ingredient of absinthe. So this is my favorite sentence in the entire article. The skull of Kenisary Kazimov may be in St. Petersburg, Russia, or it may not.
Me?
Russian officials say they don't know where it is located.
Sure.
So how did this gentleman obtain title to the Burya? This is where the story becomes slightly murky. Slightly murky? After the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia had to lease the spaceport from Kazakhstan. Over time, some Russian space companies operating there sold off assets as funding became tight. So that is how this businessman acquired this antique shuttle in 2004.
That then now people are like, no, we want that back. That's
important. In fact, it is being litigated in a court in Kazakhstan. Musa, however, said that these legal proceedings have been going on for 3 years. And if necessary, he said he would bring the matter to international court to expose the nature of the bureaucracy in Kazakhstan and its court system. But that is the idea that I have for you. A businessman holding an important piece of equipment hostage in exchange for a skull.
Can I just say, I would love to see the version of this story presented in Am I the Asshole post form.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, am I the asshole for withholding this like vital piece of equipment in exchange for a skull? And it might even be by the end of it, one of those articles, one of those posts where you're like, actually, no, I don't think you're the asshole. It sounded really bad at first, but yeah, no, I kind of get
maybe
it.
Maybe Rush is the asshole. Yeah. Well, I'm going to put 10 minutes on this timer. Am I the Asshole can be the genre for this, but I'm curious what else you guys are thinking about.
So like the first thing that comes to mind is like a satire of, they really made more of these like in the 80s, like kind of those movies like Wall Street that were kind of about like business magnates, where, you know, it's almost like a band with a writer before a concert where it's like, you know, oh, you should ask for something ridiculous just to let them know that you're serious. And so that you can see if they're like, you know, really taking all your demands seriously. And someone is like, you know, you should give, you know, you're negotiating to give the Russian government this piece of equipment back. You should ask for something like ridiculous. And the guy panics at the last moment and says the first thing that comes to mind. It's like, I want this skull. And then it's kind of a movie about like, okay, hang on. How long is he going to stick to those guns? Like, how long is he going to like, you know, like try to, you know, keep going with that demand? Or is he going to like concede at a certain point? That's like the first thing that comes to mind. Yeah.
Alternatively, it could be like a weird, like a comedic heist or like exploration type movie where the Russian government is frantically trying to find where the skull went.
Because they need it to give it back to this crazy Kazakh businessman. I love this. And so like the put upon team that are far too skilled for this mission and yet are completely befuddled by the location of this ancient skull, if it indeed still exists.
And I want to just like throw in like one more thing, because I am all in on this idea. You know, they're like, you know, we need to find this thing. So they get like their best, I don't know if it's like their best antiquities expert or their best archaeologist or whatever. And it's like, you need to go and you need to find this. And it's like, I can probably do this. But what we really need is my estranged partner who has been living outside of Russia since that incident 10 years ago. And so now like they have to go and find them and convince them to work with them together. And there's like all of this like unresolved sexual tension because they never quite got to the point where they fell into each other's arms instead of just falling into each other's research paperwork. So no, I am very here for this.
Just the shot of the power team. It's like an archivist. some sort of archaeologist, someone who's an expert in Russian like bureaucracy paperwork, understanding like the old Soviet stuff,
and accountants, then absolutely
walking through like an archival room,
right? Slow-mo, the right stuff composition, exactly.
Right.
I love this,
and I guess the tone of this Da Vinci Code, the way that Da Vinci Code actually was, with like car chases and explosions and like evil people with guns and plots? Or is it Da Vinci Code the way that it actually would be, where like you're hitting the library and spending a lot of time? Is it a research em up, I suppose?
Sure.
I think it should be. And then there's definitely imagine spots.
Uh-huh.
Where you think it's going to turn into like National Treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And then it snaps back and they're like, oh, I've been reading through these damn memos for hours and hours.
This may be complicating the mix too much, but I have a feeling that one of these protagonists really, and maybe this is part of why they parted ways, is one of them is very serious and sort of takes the discipline of academic research very seriously, and one of them always kind of wishes that they could have been a National Treasure. And so like perhaps is trying to engineer the car chases and conspiracies. And my only question about that would be, do we want this to be a world where like that's all completely engineered for comedy and is very made up? Or do they actually stumble on a real conspiracy surrounding the like magical power of the skull, and then have to like whisk it away from evil? I'm just going to cast Hugo Weaving. Sorry, Hugo Weaving.
Sure. No, I think it has to be the former. I think it has to be the one where it's all made up.
Yeah.
And I think that naturally this guy that like really wants to be National Treasure, he's the one that got kicked out. Mm-hmm. Like he's the one that, like, you know, had been like exiled to the other hemisphere because of, you know, that time when he, you know, hired those guys to pretend to be assaulting, you know, the museum, and 14 people ended up in the hospital because it all went so horribly wrong.
It was supposed to be laughing gas and it wasn't.
Is there a way we could get this to be part of the Uncharted universe?
Ooh.
I mean, like, I'm here for it 100%.
Someone who is like a really big fan of Nathan Drake.
Yeah, no,
100%. Maybe perhaps dresses like a certain Mr. Drake.
Yeah. Maybe the whole movie is just a parody of Uncharted without directly referencing it in any way.
Oh, no one would ever say the words, for sure.
It would just be very clear what was happening.
Yes. They like are super excited to go on trains for the potential of train action sequences, and then they never happen. The trains are always very smooth and on time.
They get really disappointed when the ruins don't fall apart behind them, so they like a plank loose.
And they keep almost saying it, you know, it's like they keep being like, oh, I'm sorry, that part of the region is not in our maps. You could say that it is unmapped. Just like, you know, just like it is a movie full of teases.
On the edge. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, I love that. And this is probably someone who wants to go to territories that are unpopulated and are a little bit out of the way, even though perhaps the skull is sitting in the museum in St. Petersburg all along.
Right.
So it can be a globe-trotting adventure for nothing.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, you know, like it is the equivalent of like those levels in Carmen Sandiego where you ended up right back where you started after you had circumnavigated the world like three different times.
So the subways in St. Petersburg are the deepest in the world.
Really?
And I think this demands a shot where they're like, OK, well, off to such and such. And then there's just a shot of them standing on the escalators down. In the St. Petersburg subway.
And just like live action or sort of real time.
Yeah.
Slowly descending.
As a rousing Hans Zimmer score plays behind him.
Yeah, I think that'd be perfect.
I don't know if it is the rousing Hans Zimmer score or whatever a Russian cover of The Girl from Ipanema would sound like.
The Girl from Ipanema on a balaclava.
Right.
The Girl from Minsk.
Yeah, mm-hmm, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I love this. How does it end, guys? Do they get the skull back and reforge a friendship or realize that this is why they should never work together ever again?
Oof. That's a tough one. Because like in my head, the best like real tonal comparison for something like this is like The World's End, where, you know, where you have kind of like this one guy that is refusing to grow up and trying to make his life an adventure that none of his friends actually wanted to be.
Right.
But the way that that resolves, and I would not dare to spoil it, is quite difficult to match onto this.
Unless the skull. No, I'm just
My instinct is that it kind of end on that note of like, he's not mature enough to do this, but maybe one day, like it's not completely without hope. Like he is not completely an unreasonable person.
Okay.
Yeah.
And perhaps is responsible for the actual finding of the skull. So has skills buried underneath all of the immaturity.
Causes a lot of property damage along the way, though. Like just like the collateral damage is like, well, we think we're gonna break even, maybe.
I think the romantic storyline wraps up with him trying really hard to be like mysterious and suave.
Uh huh.
And then like something happens and he gets tricked into being like actually sincere for once.
Ooh, mm-hmm. I like that.
I love that a lot. And he's like, oh, this works. I must never do it again.
Yeah, exactly. There's a brief shining moment of potential.
Is that what it's called? What's the title for this?
Off the map.
Off the map.
Three heads are better than one.
Off the map is pretty good. I like that.
Off the map is pretty good. And that's time. Well done, everyone. This was great. I'm so here for a vehicle to drag the Uncharted series. This is excellent.
As someone who loves the Uncharted series, I'm also here for it.
Yeah. What a find, Sarah. I don't know if I hope that it's true or I hope that it's not true, but that, like, that's a wild story.
It's a thing that exists, is what I can say about it.
Yeah.
Well, that's... I did look up the Buria while you were reading it, and I didn't bring this in while we were discussing it, because I figured it wasn't relevant, but apparently it's an intercontinental cruise missile.
Hmm.
Oh, cool.
Specifically?
Cool.
So wait a minute. So is this like a form of... This is like something out of a James Bond movie. Like, if you don't give me the head of, like, you know, this famous leader, I will not give you back the nuclear weapon or like the long range missile that I've got.
I guess it explains more of why the Russian government wants it back.
Yeah. Ooh.
At least this is what Wikipedia says. As we know, very reliable source always.
Well, it's yet on another, the internet.
Yep. So. Never wrong. Very dependable.
All right. Well, we will double check the Wikipedia footnotes for this and be back in a couple moments with more bad ideas.
Hello there, Zach Valenti jumping into this episode with this brief reminder that we have an active Patreon page to support the production of No Bad Ideas and all the other crazy worlds we're building behind the scenes. To check that out, scope the sweet rewards we offer for monthly subscriptions, as well as how to sign up yourself. Head on over to nobadideaspodcast.com/support. Once more, that's nobadideaspodcast.com/support. If you already support the show, we so appreciate that. And regardless, thank you for listening. All right, let's get back to more No Bad Ideas.
Righty, we are back from our Wikipedia rabbit hole deep dives with the lovely and amazing Zoe Tsukishige. Thank you so much for hanging out with us a little bit more, Zoe.
As you know, I hate hanging out with you guys, so it's a real struggle.
We appreciate your sacrifice. We appreciate it greatly.
It's noted and appreciated. But because you are not just a friend of the show, but a friend of the show who is an author with a book that is coming out next year, we wanted to ask you a little bit about your journey into writing and your process a little bit. How did you end up making a different mistake than the two of us have made, but an equal mistake of writing a novel?
Well, the book is a little bit interesting because I wrote it on, I guess, like commission kind of for a book packaging company, which is a thing that a lot of people outside of publishing don't really know about. But basically, they own like the IP to a series or something. And then a lot of times they'll contract out writers to write it.
Very cool.
So some examples might be like, I think like Nancy Drew is kind of like that.
Sure, sure.
That sort of thing. Yeah, so the packaging company has the connections and has an agent. And I happened to intern for this company when I was right out of college.
Oh, cool.
So when they were looking for an author for this book, Danielle, who's the CEO, sent me a text and was like, "We thought of you right away. Would you like to write it?" And I said yes, and then had to write a book. So that was hard.
Yeah, I mean, there you go. There's the bad choice right there. Like, that was the moment and the fork in the road where the bad choice was made.
Yeah, I've been having an advantage in that it was outlined for me.
Uh-huh.
Like, they pretty much had the blueprint for what they wanted the book to be. So I didn't have to come up with as many, like, plot devices or anything like that. But I did still have to do the writing.
Right. You still had to tangle with the blank page at the very least.
Yeah. For a first time author, it's actually kind of an interesting and good way to experience it because I don't have to deal with a lot of the more legal sides. Like they handle that part.
Right.
And so that's nice. for me.
Excellent. We like Excellent. Things that are nice for you.
Yeah.
But you still had to actually do writing, which is, as all three of us know, the worst.
It's actually the hardest thing that anyone does. Like, I think the data is in. It is the hardest thing.
I mean, if you look at it, you're creating something out of nothing.
It's true. So basically, we're gods.
Yeah.
Every time we do it.
You say that as a joke, but we are the gods to our books or to our writing.
I'm kind of curious because you are not only a god of writing, but also a god of other creative endeavors. You draw, you've done photography. How is writing like a very separate muscle for you, or is it just part of like the whole creating apparatus?
I would say it's different because writing feels like something that I have to do in terms of who I am as a person. Like, telling stories is just part of who I am, and writing is the way I choose to express those stories. Drawing and like, I do needlework and stuff like that, that's more of just, those are hobbies. I would definitely say they're hobbies as opposed to like vocations. I enjoy doing them. They're great creative outlets, but I don't feel driven to do it. Like, it's not the feeling of being like hit with a bolt of lightning and being like, I have to go find my computer and sit down and type this down.
Right.
So that's how I would separate the two.
Cool.
So it's interesting that you kind of came into this, as you say, with, you'd already kind of had a lot of this story sort of handed to you. You got the blueprint, as it were. Once you kind of like began from there, what would you say was the hardest part of the process? Did you kind of find yourself ever running into moments when you had to deviate from the blueprint, where you had to kind of figure out how to make things fit that maybe kind of had seemed like a great fit at 10,000 feet above? And then once you got a little bit closer, it was a little bit more challenging. Sort of what was the harder parts of the process?
So part of the reason, this wasn't the reason they picked me, but they shifted the setting of the story to Hawaii, which is where my mom is from. So a lot of the writing process involved just localizing things to that and rewriting and putting in a lot of things to try and make it feel authentic, because I didn't grow up in Hawaii, but I wanted it to feel like it was someone who was living in Hawaii.
Right, like you were doing justice to it.
And I'm very sensitive to the fact that it's, you know, there's a lot of complicating factors in writing about Hawaii as someone who is not Hawaiian. And so I feel like I was given a lot of liberty with how I wanted to change stuff. And I think I just came into it with sort of a different viewpoint on why the character does the things that she does. Like, I'm definitely a very psychological writer. I think a lot about why the character is doing the things that they do, even if it doesn't necessarily make it onto the page. So some of the story beats like didn't work because that's just not who the character was anymore.
Right.
But they're very open, very receptive to me making it my own.
That's awesome. Are you the kind of person who tends to write like a lot of sort of ancillary materials and backstory, or do you just sort of like get a sense of who a character is and then just try and ask questions about what they'll do going forward?
Or do you kind of find the people on the page as you write the thing itself and then kind of like go back and reshape?
I definitely find the people on the page more. I think it's kind of related to, I think better when I'm talking to people. Like, if I'm trying to work something out, it's why I love having a writer's group, because talking through issues I'm having with something I'm writing is so much more productive to me than typing it out, because I kind of think as I'm speaking and like it helps the thoughts flow. So writing and then revising and going back and thinking over the choices that I made helps me figure out who the character is as I go.
Awesome. Now, in terms of your writing habits themselves, are you someone that kind of writes, let's put this a little bit more directly, that you kind of need to feel the heat of the deadline as it like looms over you in order to be able to write? Do you kind of have like daily goals? Do you kind of sort of like, what is your writing habit as you tackle something as big as a novel?
I am not a disciplined person in general. I do work much better with a deadline. Mm-hmm. When I was working on this, I did try to at least book out weekends where I would sit down for some period of time and write something, like go over a section, that kind of thing. But I've noticed that something that I do a lot is that I won't write for a long period of time, but I'll be thinking a lot about it. And then by the time I'm ready to sit down and actually start typing, I've thought about it so much that I have a pretty clear idea of what I want to do. And that's something that's new, because I used to write every day. That changed in 2016 for reasons mm-hmm. I'm sure you can relate to.
Sure.
And I have not been nearly as disciplined or nearly as consistent or disciplined writing every day. Mm-hmm. But I spend a lot more time thinking about what I want to write. And as a result, I think when I sit down to do so, I generally have a clearer vision of what it is I want to do.
That awesome. Makes a lot of sense.
Now, speaking of having kind of a vision of how you want things to unfold, this is a question that's perhaps a little bit more left to field, but you did talk about this up front in the first part of the show, so I'm going to treat it as inbounds. But as you mentioned, Sarah and I are in a Dungeons and Dragons group that you run, so you are mm-hmm. a god of sorts in that world as well. Basically, sort of like, who is more obtrusive to the writing process and to kind of figuring things out, characters that are all sort of like within you and that you have to kind of find out how they map onto things, or players who will bring some of it onto the table, but who perhaps will go in a very different direction than what you may have ever envisaged as happening.
You mean
happening.
Like Tabaxi the Musical?
This we is have a no... funny joke for six people.
Right.
A one-off joke that I made that has become a whole entire plot point. I think that the plot processes are completely, or the writing processes for those two things are completely different. Mm-hmm. Just because I view Dungeons & Dragons as a collaborative writing experience. I come in with the world. I have like NPCs who exist and have lives. But in the end, the protagonists are the players. And so I have to build the narrative around them. And in a lot of ways, it's an interesting difference, because I think character driven stories in general are better, and Dungeons and Dragons is by the nature of it character driven, because it's the character choices that change the plot. And as you guys make different choices, I have to come up with things in the world that react to that and try and find ways to accommodate the thing you're interested in exploring about your character. Like, for example, Sarah's character has decided that she wants to take religious orders properly. Mm-hmm. So I've been looking up different homebrew things for how people do that and figuring out how I'm going to make it work for this character. How am I going to make that work into the like big overarching plot that I have in my head for the whole campaign.
Right.
But the end of, like, so I have sort of a larger narrative planned for it, but the individual stories and the individual themes are created by the players. As opposed to if I'm writing something myself, I kind of know what themes I'm interested in exploring. And a lot of times the plot kind of comes to me. Mm-hmm. Based on, like, I'll have an idea, but then especially in revision, like, things will change so much mm-hmm. based on how people respond to it or whether or not things are clear. So they're two very different ways of creating story.
Awesome. Needless to say, I think that you do a fantastic job of kind of balancing the needs of our characters, which should be read as all the bullshit that we throw at you. With actually taking us to a satisfying plot. I haven't reached the ending of it yet, but we've definitely had a couple of culminations, which have been great. So I guess this is just us saying thank you and we're sorry.
I knew what I was getting myself into.
Yeah, but like you didn't quite anticipate playing the NPC that you are balancing right now, who is connected to Gabrielle's character in a way I don't think you were anticipating.
I did know that at some point I was going to have to play Gabrielle's ex-girlfriend, and I was really not happy about that.
Look, the plot just makes us do, you know, the what it makes us do. We are all just puppets of it along
I'm
the
so
way.
I'm so annoyed that she came back right after we started doing in-person sessions again, because now I have to look you in your human face while I am doing her part.
So much. The one thing Roll 20 is better at.
Yeah.
We found it. We finally did find it. Wow.
Oh, man. Well, Zoe, if people want to find you and follow you and your work, where on the internet should they go to do that?
My Twitter is just my name, Zoe Tokushige, Zoe Tokushige. My email is, or my website is zoetokushige.com. I also have a link to my Instagram there. It's not remotely professional, but you can see some fun pictures of recently mostly dogs. One specific dog named Benny.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. He's a very good boy.
Yeah, he's a very good boy. There might actually be a picture of Sarah there recently.
Potentially.
I mean, this sounds like the content that I go to the internet for. Dogs.
Oh no,
and Sarah.
You didn't make it in.
Never mind.
I do have
just
one
dogs.
Polaroid with you in it, but it's extremely blurry.
Excellent. That's how I like to be photographed. Blurry Polaroids.
Blurrily.
All
yeah.
the way. Well, Zoe, thank you so much again for coming and spinning some very bad ideas with us. We shall have to do it again. Hopefully with Zach. Hopefully we can make that happen. And the two of you can face off for the rights to the third bad idea chair or something. There'll be initiatives. They'll be rolled. It'll be great.
I'll be on literally anytime you ask me.
Wow. Yay. Thank you so much.
You're my friends.
Aw.
And thank you everyone for tuning in and for listening to No Bad Ideas. And we'll be back next week with more bad, more ideas, more no, but slightly in a better order than that one. Until then, see you soon.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Many thanks to our patrons for their partnership in making this show happen. And a special shout out to our Idealist members, Jennifer Schneider, Rena Sarame, Jeffrey Felsher, and Dia. Today's episode features music by Stateshire and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at nobadideaspodcast.com/support. And if you love this show, please leave a rating or review wherever you listen and share it with someone you love. Thanks.